and as the last sufferer, I welcome Paul Harper to appear for the first time at this conference, and his wife Joan, who's here with him somewhere in the room. You're welcome. Well, first of all, I have a confession to make, Paul. I was looking for a little old man. We all had to meet.
I really am a little old.
Are you?
I'm actually 103.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And when I read your bio, I sat and thought, how am I going to turn this into a 1-minute soundbite? I just cannot do it justice. And then I started wondering about what you must have been like as a little boy, and if you had any idea that you would turn out to do or be any of these things which I'm about to list. An educator, a researcher, a composer, a writer, a lecturer, a recording artist, a scientist, a technology geek. I hope that's not an insult. And that you have had such a great interest in the phenomenon of channeling psychology and spirituality that you would actually begin writing a book about those subjects. Quite amazing for such a young guy sitting next to me, and I hope you'll now enlighten us with at least a few good words of creativity and pain and suffering.
That's a tough act to follow. Now I will just burst the bubble. There's a lot of hats that I wear, so I'm just try to imagine my first panel yesterday. I was with Roger Ebert talking about evolution and creationism. And so this is a godsend. This is my right brain moment. So I'm going to spare you with the deep philosophy and whatnot, but just talk briefly about it, just to let you know. There's this thing called integral conscious creation that I've been developing, and it's based on the idea of conscious creation, or you create your own reality. How many people out there have read a Seth book or heard of Jane Roberts? Just a show of hands. Okay, 20%, 1 in 5. That's the conscious creation part. The integral part is from Ken Wilber's work. How many of you have heard of Ken Wilber or familiar with his work? Now, in this group, I get that many hands. I've been disappointed, actually, in other audiences, how many hands go up with that are not familiar with Ken's work. Creative people are certainly drawn to this integral approach of his. So that's a large theoretical tone that I'm working on, because I need to know who I am, why I'm here, and how all this works. How do you do that, right? So there's different ways to try and do that, and I'm going to spare you from them today, because there's some arcane arguments and whatnot about that. Playing off of my previous speakers, the hardest part is getting started for me creatively, as a writer, as a composer, and I want to talk a little bit about designing museum exhibits, because that's a collaborative process. So I've done the solo thing, I'm trained as a solo composer, and that's the Beethoven with the thunderbolts in the background and the visionary solo thing, to being a team player, negotiating with the team, and fighting like cats and dogs periodically, and inevitably when the deadline comes, it comes together, and it's usually high quality stuff in my experience. So that's a tribute to that process, but it can be very painful along the way, but it's also very, very joyous. As a creative person, I'm constantly wrestling with my deep intuition and my intellect. And you've heard this saying, it's 10% perspiration, 90%
Inspiration,
thank you. For me, it's about 4% inspiration and 96% perspiration. It's trying to tap into the muse. I want to talk a little bit about my muse. If she's there, if she's listening, or if I'm listening for her, and if she can come through me. If I can tap into that. I'm in touch with my feminine side, by the way. So I identified with everything you described, so don't really get me. Yeah, well, for sure. So what I try to do, just generally speaking, is to tap into that muse and get inspired. And there's no set way to do that. I don't have a science of doing that. That is an intuitive process. But the axiom I have is, when the muse speaks, listen and capture it, no matter where you are, no matter what context you're in. That's why we carry voice recorders with us, things to capture that bit. You just need a little seed thought, and suddenly chapters can come from that, movements in a symphony can come from that, a whole conceptual framework can be revealed to you, and you can spend years filling it in like this integral conscious creation thing. I mentioned You Create Reality in the Seth books. That's part of, those were produced by a woman named Jane Roberts who lives in Elmira, New York. She was what's conventionally called a channeler. There's not a good scientific explanation to define the channeling phenomenon. That has driven a lot of my research work in that area of late. She produced, I think it's 39 published books now. So I want to talk a little bit about Jane, because she's been an inspiration to me. I guess she's a physical muse to me. And actually in dream state, she's been very inspiring too. 39 books, I believe about 19 are Seth material. She's written books, a children's book, books of fiction, and poetry. An incredibly creative woman. And this channel source named Seth is what came through her. And the idea of conscious creation, you create your own reality. The word creation keeps coming up, creativity. It's at the core of our being, of our consciousness, of what we are as consciousness. And I'm just so pleased that this group at least understands when I put that into play. I've come from two science panels where consciousness is right out. The empirical method is right in, and so that's very important. Over the years, some methods I've used based on the Seth material are doing dream work. And if you read any of the Seth books, there's a series of three books that you can get started with, and there's a bunch of practices in there to just start playing around with this stuff. One of them is keeping a dream journal. This is listening to the muse. Our muse is speaking to us in our dreams all the time, every night, but we don't remember. Culturally, we are taught dreams are not important. We're dreamers, right? Being a dreamer is not such a good thing. There are contexts where it's a wonderful thing. I think everybody just about in this audience is a dreamer of some kind or another, so you understand where I'm coming from with that. The phenomenon of lucid dreaming, I just wanted to touch on that. That's where you become as awake as you are right now, with this awareness that you have right now in the dream state. And you can incubate dreams and learn to actually tap into and play out ideas. You can rehearse a performance if you're practicing something and you need to continue practicing. And you have, there's a case that I read about, and this has always stuck with me. I have not done this personally, but this is just an example. We're just looking for seeds here. Of a person who had a terrible phobia of performing publicly. They would practice, but as soon as they got in front, and they did a dream incubation experiment of mentally, before going to sleep, imagining themselves getting on the stage, being very relaxed, sitting down, and then not thinking about what they were going to play, and just play right through it. Sure enough, within a couple of nights, they had a lucid dream. They went right through the same process, sat down, made it through the whole piece, really for the first time, that they couldn't do in waking state. They came back from that with a whole sense of concentration, because that's all it is. When you're making mistakes and dropping notes, it's a lack of concentration. So developing concentration is part of this creative process. This, and I don't focus on pain and suffering a lot. There's plenty of it in the world, but you can superimpose on some of my comments, I guess, the pain and suffering of this process. I also wanted to mention with Jane Roberts that she, as a writer, and it's very interesting to me, because I've always wanted to do it. It's like, I want to sit down and channel this book. I get out of the way. I don't have to suffer. I don't have to rework anything. None of these drugs. And just let this thing come through. And Jane had this gift, and she didn't incubate it. It manifests spontaneously in her. And my current theory is that it had to do with her own developmental intelligences opening up to an extremely virtuosic level, that egoically she could step aside in waking state and let the muse come through. And how well you can translate that or not, it is the challenge of what you do. In Jane's case, she wrote published two worldview books, they're called, where she tapped into a worldview. If you've heard of the Akashic Records in New Age spiritual circles, it's the idea that there's energy deposits or a vast library of information, and it's real based on my own altered state and altered experience. She would tap into the worldview of William James and Paul Cézanne, a painter. Her husband was a painter, and because of that love she had for her husband, Rob Butts, and his painting, she was able to open to her muse, allow this to tap into Cézanne's worldview, get out of the way. And the cool thing, and also I believe the Oversoul 7 books, which is sort of a science fiction thing, and it's actually one of my favorite Jane Roberts fiction, the Oversoul 7 books. The cool thing, and I'm so envious, she would get chapter 10 first, then parts of chapter 8, then a little of chapter 17, then back to chapter 1, 2, and 3, and she didn't rework the material much. She was tapping into this thing, and it was being delivered in bits and pieces, and there it was put together. Now, this is the story that I've read about. I never met Jane. I never talked to her. Maybe, you know, she hedged her bets a little bit in the process. But still, getting a chapter 10 before chapter 1, and this thing's coming out. You're in the middle of a story. There's characters here. They're doing stuff. And actually, it was an example of a Seth concept called simultaneous time, which is a perception from the soul level that all of these focused personalities in time are all perceived simultaneously. We're not existing in simultaneous time in this awareness we have right now. People sometimes confuse that on my email lists that I manage. Just on to museum exhibits and the collaborative process, it's great having a large budget. It's great having $1 million. But I'll tell you something, $1 million, you know, salaries, overhead, overtime, all of a sudden, you know, you're down to about $300,000 that's actually being spent on stuff. So it becomes a game of learning to manage and budget accurately. And the deadline. I loved your comment about the deadline. Nothing makes you shit or get off the pot sooner than a deadline. And it seems to always work, though, more or less. I'm sure there's crash and burn stories that we all have where it doesn't work out. The last thing I want to talk about is the CD that I released 2 years ago called Mindscapes, which the Mindscape concept is basically conscious creation. And the idea that whatever music I create, you're going to perceive and create your own mental landscape of that. And these are all instrumental pieces, and I just wanted to talk about one and its construction because it's the finale on there. And the title is called Espresso, Please. And I mentioned earlier about listening to the muse. This happened it was a winter morning, I'm guessing somewhere around 1993. It's a weekend, I'm relaxed, I'm still working at the Science Museum, have a cup of coffee, I'm feeling good, energetic. I sit down at the piano to just jam. I will just sit down and jam at the keyboard. And I love to improvise on my flute to CDs and whatnot. I do a mean Jethro Tull and Ian Anderson. So I sit down at the piano and the muse is speaking. Suddenly, something is there and you can feel it coming out. There's a parapsychologist named John Climo, I'm not sure how it's pronounced because I've never met him. He calls it open channeling. So I wasn't channeling Seth. Seth wasn't coming through. That's a whole different phenomenon. But we all of us as creative writers, artists, graphic artists, whatever, are doing some form of open channeling, I believe, when that muse is free. When you get in that inspired state, you lose your sense of identity. All time stops. Outside noise, nothing. You are just there inside this concept. Sitting at the piano, this thing is coming out of me, and I get the progression, I capture it, I've learned to capture it, I get it in a place that I can remember it, and I realize, this is the end. This is chapter 10. Cool. But I captured that, I went down to the studio and I turned on my MIDI keyboards and recording software and captured it, a version of it. That was my 5% inspiration. It took me several weeks after that to rewrite, take the thing, and actually, if this was my closing finale, I put it at the beginning, I wanted to open with it, and then I needed a middle section as a contrast. And I actually wrote the middle section second. The piece wrote itself backwards. Even so, the muse was still whispering in my ear after this sort of beautiful finale that's just inspiring, and I would love to arrange it for orchestra someday, and hopefully it would make your hair stand up because it's so beautiful. But so I'll just end with that. Perfect ending for this thing. It was my finale, so that will be my finale. Thank you.
Do you want to ask a couple of questions?
I was going to say that in terms of Paul's, the idea of channeling, with this book that I was having so much trouble with, I finally decided, and I always do a little bit of meditation or something before I get, almost always, not always, but I decided, since I couldn't even get the book going, I thought, well, just write down, I'd heard a director once say, when he couldn't figure out where a scene should go, that he would take the part of the director and the actor, you know, and sit, you know, stand up, sit down. I thought, well, mine doesn't come through verbalization. It comes through my hand. So I wrote down on my page, I've already had my protagonist in mind. I said, where are we going? Where do you want to go in this? And I really was kind of in a trance, and she wrote me back and said, I don't know, you're writing this book. it was a little devastating. But
hoping for somebody.
Open it up to questions. And if you were a student and you were on a real tight time budget, I'd like to ask you to ask questions first, and then the rest of us will participate. So, Eddie,
can I have a quick pause here?
Sure, please.
It's available on iTunes. You can download it for 99 cents a song or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
Mindscapes.
Okay, question. Are you a student?
No. Do I have to be a student?
No.
You may have.
I was.
Good.
About 100 years ago. In terms of the creative process, don't you think that Mozart's and the Beethoven's? You understand what I'm saying? If you go to the notebooks, I mean Mozart didn't need notebooks.
What?
Just wrote.
Can you repeat it? I can't repeat the question. You're asking about Mozart and Beethoven,
yeah,
and something that's so spectacular.
I think they're two different processes. Totally.
As far as Mozart and Beethoven go?
Yeah.
I see.
Great composers. They seem to have two different...
Certainly. A way I try to understand this is looking at developmental intelligence theory. Howard Gardner, a Harvard researcher, psychologist, published a book called Frames of Mind around 1988 and put forth the theory that we all have developmental intelligence. Musical is one of them. Kinesthetic, verbal, linguistic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, our relationship with ourselves, and so on. And they're continuing to build research to show that. In Mozart's case, he was a child prodigy. Beethoven was a child prodigy also. But what I can't measure it. I'm putting on my scientist hat for the moment. I would be interested in seeing that musical line being so high at such a young age, and all the other lines at a much lower development. Mm-hmm. But he was in a family that nurtured that particular line, and it was a case of exceedingly uneven development. I think it may have led to his premature death at the age of 36. And Ludwig lived to be 57, but he had some problems as he got older with his deafness. Beethoven did this perspiration process too, but he heard the muse in his mind. My favorite Beethoven symphony is the sixth, the Pastoral. And his notebooks, we've studied them in music history, and you get the little motifs and the themes and little bits worked out that he's doing this away from the piano. When I was being trained, I was trained to try and emulate this behavior as a composer, and I never succeeded in developing that modality that I could just hear it in my head and translate it into notation, a language, and do that. So that's just some general comments on how I see that happening. Everybody is a totally unique individual. All of us. Absolute one time only in all of eternity. We're all very special in that regard, but I mean that from the heart. So our own developmental streams are a jumble of different levels.